Chapter 11. In October 1940, Joseph Kennedy had left his post as ambassador to the United Kingdom and returned to Washington, D.C. Bitter at being, for all practical purposes, recalled by FDR, he said he was "damn sore about the way I have been treated. I feel that it is entirely unreasonable, and I don't think I rated it." By December, Joe had resigned, but not without chewing at Roosevelt for what amounted to a dismissal. In turn, FDR told his son-in-law, according to author David Nassau, "The truth of the matter is that Joe is and has always been a temperamental Irish boy, terrifically spoiled at an early age by huge financial success, thoroughly patriotic, thoroughly selfish." Joe Kennedy now had to decide whether any presidential ambitions were squelched through his unfortunate departure as ambassador to England. As early as 1938, there had been speculation, one article having appeared in the popular magazine Liberty asking the question, "Will Kennedy run for president?" Further, author Ronald Kessler wrote, "Roosevelt said he knew Joe wanted to be the first Catholic president." Kessler further offered a quote from Joe's friend Arthur Crock that Joe hoped to be nominated in 1940 without any question. No nomination would ever appear due to the unkind characterizations of Joe Kennedy, especially in the media. The New York Herald Tribune wrote that the termination of Joe's unfortunate career as ambassador meant Americans could breathe more easily. Author J. Randy Tarabarelli wrote, "Politically, Joseph was poison. He had completely destroyed his own political career and reputation by making negative comments about FDR and seeming to endorse some of Hitler's policies. Such notions and Joe's knowledge that any presidential ambitions were lost caused him to turn his attention to real estate development. But that didn't mean the Oval Office wasn't in his mind. If he couldn't be president, then he was determined that one of his sons would occupy the office, permitting him to live vicariously through them. When his favorite son, Joe Jr., was killed during World War II, Jack was the substitute, next in line, as noted. And it is not a far cry to believe that when Jack was elected president, Joe must have believed that when his two terms were completed, there would be Bobby, the assistant president, ready to carry on the Kennedy dynasty. Certainly, Joe would have the last laugh over FDR and those who had made it, in Joe's mind, impossible for him to become the most powerful man in the world. Instead, the power-hungry Joe would, for all practical purposes, be president without the title, since he controlled both sons through his domineering presence. If one gives the elder Kennedy the benefit of the doubt, it could be argued that he never believed Bobby would evoke such hatred, or that his obsession to obliterate the Mafia and James Hoffa would rise to such a fever pitch, giving the Kennedy family enemies no choice but to strike back with vengeance due to double crosses across the board with men whom Joe knew were dangerous, had killed, and would kill again. But Joe knew for certain of Bobby's obsessive pursuit of dangerous men like Hoffa, Marcello, Cohen, Trafficante, and others through his work on the McClellan Committee. Regarding Marcello, a former Louisiana journalist who requested anonymity and thus will be identified only by his first name, John, due to fear of members of the Marcello family still alive today, told this author in December 2020 that he met Marcello at a very early age through his grandfather. John stated, "I am Sicilian by birth and grew up in a blue-collar ethnic neighborhood in New Orleans. There were Italian grocers on almost every corner. It smelled like garlic for blocks. There were also bars. My grandfather, who worked at the American Sugar Refinery, would take me bar hopping after Sunday morning mass. We would hit three joints, Pat's, Ralph Imbruglio's, which was hopping, and then, finally, the famous Social Club, front for a mob branch of Marcello's general business. It was full of old gonoffs, pickpocket, thief, with big noses, and it was as dark as Marcello's heart was then. Ralph's was a blast. It was full of ex-prize fighters with flat noses, talking animatedly while thumbing their noses and gesticulating in a pugilistic fashion. I loved them. They thumbed over quarters and Kennedy halves to Mr. Vincent's grand brat, ostensibly to play the jukebox. I pocketed every one of them and pretended to punch buttons on the Rockola. One day at Ralph's, a small, chubby man was buzzed in. He had two guys with him that had their own area codes. The galoots were dressed in dapper fashion, black being the primary theme. The Don, while wearing a thin tie and cardigan sweater, looked more like the old man feeding pigeons in the park. All these gonifs rushed up to him like the peasants to the Pope. My grandfather stood back with me, then shook the great man's hand and introduced me. He was all of 5'2", so he didn't have to stoop low to shake my hand. He said, "I am your Uncle Carlos." He wasn't my real uncle, that's just what everybody called him. But he had these cold eyes, and later I learned this mobster would kill without even blinking an eye. Predictably, hatred spewed at every turn through the deportation of the dangerous Marcello, through the racial slurs toward the gangsters in RFK's book The Enemy Within, and through knowledge that JFK shared a girlfriend, Judith Campbell Exner, with gangster Giancana, which certainly compromised the presidency. In his book, JFK presidential advisor Ted Sorensen admits meeting Exner beside a pool during a campaign stop in Nevada while noting, "After 1956, I was vaguely aware of a few flings and fancies for JFK along the campaign trail." This history dictated the certainty that Bobby, who Joe admitted hated like him, would act with relentlessness toward forces of evil, who in turn saw RFK as an enemy of the first degree. RFK's vendetta was predictable. Any fool could have seen it coming based on past behavior. This must have included knowledge that at one point James Hoffa had actually attempted to choke RFK while threatening to kill him during an altercation Frank Regano chronicled when RFK kept Hoffa waiting at a Washington, D.C. meeting so the Attorney General could walk his dog. Certainly, one man who understood how dangerous RFK's enemies could be if they believed they had been double-crossed was Frank Regano. Touching on it briefly in his book, Mob Lawyer, but without going into detail, he wrote, "Joseph Kennedy made a commitment for his sons, no all-out assault on Hoffa or the Mafia, and they had violated it. By reneging on a bargain, the Kennedys became fair game for the savage vindictiveness of the Mafia rulers, despots who survived through a polluted code that obligates them to avenge the merest slight." Focusing on Marcello, Regano concluded, "As for Carlos, his criminal organizational skills bordered on the brilliant. Through judicious bribery and political influence, he kept the Louisiana law enforcement establishment in his pocket for over 30 years while he amassed a personal fortune. On the federal level, he defied the Kennedys by returning home after deportation to Guatemala, and then defeated their further efforts in the courts to oust him from the country. Bottom line, John Kennedy did not have to become a mafia target in 1963, but for the actions of Joe Kennedy forcing JFK to appoint RFK Attorney General, and then Bobby continuing his personal crusade against those men he despised with an even greater vengeance than before. These actions sealed the president's fate. One unnecessary, one unwarranted, one that could have been avoided. JFK was definitely a flawed man, but he did not deserve to die because of the reckless actions of his father and brother. That JFK could have been killed by others who had reason to eliminate him is certainly possible, but the perfect storm existed in late 1963 due to the hatred Marcello had for Bobby, leading to an assassination based on revenge." Such common-sense logic presents an interesting question. Who did Joe Kennedy believe assassinated his son? Who was the most logical person or persons in his mind when he learned of the news that JFK had been killed? Discovering this identity is difficult since, from media reports and from Ted Schwartz's writings about Joseph Kennedy, it is known that Joe was on a steady decline, no longer capable of making a sound. Other reports stated that the immobilized elder Kennedy could not write and could only mumble the words, "No, no, no." This was due to his stroke in December 1961, He had suffered an intracranial thrombosis, a blood clot in the brain, causing one to wonder whether Joe's acute medical condition, leaving him wheelchair-bound and helpless, basically a cripple with a deformed hand for life, counted as fateful atonement for his sins. Schwartz noted that there were conflicting stories regarding how Joe learned of the death of his son, the president. The author wrote that some believed the telephone call was made by Lyndon Johnson. Another such story, according to Schwartz, indicated that with Eunice by his side, Ted told his father, "Dad, Jack was shot." Visualizing this sad moment, Schwartz wrote, "Joe sat up in bed, was given a sedative, and read the story in the New York Times. He finished, swept the paper to the floor, and lay back down to sleep." A third account was included in Charles Higham's book, Rose. The author reported that after RFK had been notified of JFK's death and had told the Kennedy matriarch, she insisted that Joe should not be told the news, and to that end, Higham wrote, "Rose and the staff entered into a loving conspiracy, to the effect that Joe's television set was unplugged and others set to a low volume. When Joe objected, they took him on the handicapped elevator to the basement theater and played Elvis Presley's film Kid Galahad, one of his favorites." Higham revealed that Rose took a long walk along the beach, realizing, the author wrote, that if she collapsed, the whole family would fall apart. She must be strong and resolute, whatever happened. When she returned, Ted handled telling Joe of his son's death. Higham then, based on primary source interviews with family members, reported that after Rose went to bed at 2 a.m. on Thanksgiving, a heart-rending scream woke her from her sleep. It was Joe's voice. The author wrote that Joe was sitting up in bed, shrieking in horror. The coffin flag he had been given covered him except for his face, his left hand clutched to it, trying to pull it off. It was as though he were being buried himself, as though he was sharing his son's death. When he swept the New York Times to the floor, what was Joe Kennedy thinking? When he was covered in the coffin flag, what was going through his tortured mind? Did he get it? Did he realize instantly what had happened, as others did? Among them, his own son Bobby, who had uttered, "There's so much bitterness, I thought they would get one of us, but Jack, after all he had been through, I never worried about it. I never thought it would happen. I thought it would be me." Did Joe have enough wits left, enough logic and common sense to realize those responsible for JFK's assassination were Bobby's enemies, the Kennedy family enemies, namely those in the mafia who had been double-crossed? Based on his knowledge of revenge as an integral part of mafia power operatives, especially when they were betrayed, Joe must have known, must have believed that his son's killers were easy to identify, easy to blame. If he did, then the guilt he felt must have been overwhelming, even stronger than that experienced by RFK. This was especially true since, according to Arthur Schlesinger, Joe told John Siegenthaler, "I don't want my enemies to be my son's enemies." But they were. And it is plausible to believe that Joe must have wondered whether JFK, as suggested earlier, had become a victim of Bobby's obsession to destroy James Hoffa and bloodthirsty mobsters whom RFK believed were the worst filth of American society. In an ironic twist of fate, Joe outlived both Jack and Bobby. This means Joe had to endure the pain of losing both sons to assassins as his health deteriorated toward his death in 1969, 6 years after the assassination of JFK and a little over a year after RFK was killed. Of Joe Kennedy, author Ted Schwartz wrote, "He had spent his life hating the people he wanted to emulate, desperately seeking acceptance in all the wrong places. He had sold his soul in all the wrong places for all the wrong reasons. He had gained the world, and in 8 years between helplessness and death, he had seen it all fall apart." That Joe betrayed those he promised, especially the underworld figures who hated RFK, that he double-crossed them, should come as no surprise, for this was a man who had betrayed people who had trusted him his entire life, whether it was wife Rose, friends, or business associates such as James Roosevelt, President Franklin D. Roosevelt's son and later a California congressman. Author Ronald Kessler quotes Jimmy as saying, "I think Jack's father was one of the most evil, disgusting men I have ever known. Oh, I know he was a financial genius, but he was a rotten human being." Such a description is indicative of decisions Joe made before and after JFK was elected president. They include the dubious business dealings, including stock market manipulation during the crash of 1929, multiple accounts of adultery, aiding in the fixing of the 1960 election, lying to and then double-crossing powerful mafia bosses regarding his promise of no further prosecution after JFK's election, and especially forcing Jack to appoint Bobby Attorney General when he should have known the predictable consequences. Joe once commented to House Speaker Tip O'Neill, "Bobby's my boy. When Bobby hates you, you stay hated." All of these decisions triggered disastrous consequences, but the fact that Joe knew RFK hated men like Hoffa, Trafficante, and Marcello caused a chain reaction that could only end in tragedy. Of all the Kennedys, Joe's behavior was the most arrogant and reckless, qualifying as hubris on the scale of a Greek tragedy, resulting in what may rightly be called the fall of the House of Kennedy. Predictably, the poison that resulted from his being morally, ethically, and spiritually bankrupt had most definitely spread to RFK, causing him to be morally, ethically, and spiritually bankrupt. Like Joe, Bobby was arrogant, hypocritical, power-struck, and of the mind that he was above the law. To be certain, Father Joe, as the initial trigger point for his son John's death, by becoming the enabler for RFK's ascent to power and his abuse thereof, had truly reaped what he had sown and more. His punishment? The debilitating stroke that left him incapacitated during the final years of his life when he suffered the loss of both John and Bobby. One may only imagine his mindset day after day, sitting in his wheelchair with the knowledge that not one but both beloved sons had been murdered. If one believes in the Buddhist karmic effect, where the actions of one cause a ripple effect outward to others, including family members, then Joe's unscrupulous way of life warrants the conclusion that his conduct led to the tragic deaths of both sons. Those with Christian leanings may recall Proverbs chapter 3, verse 33, for an answer. "The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked." Does this mean that the Kennedy family was truly cursed? Former New York Times Magazine editor-in-chief and best-selling author Edward Klein believed so. He wrote, "The Kennedy curse is the result of the destructive collision between the Kennedys' fantasy of omnipotence, their need to get away with things that others cannot, and the cold, hard realities of life." He added, "The Kennedys felt immune to mortal laws and somehow divinely protected from the inevitable consequences of their deeds and misdeeds. In their hunger for unlimited power, they saw themselves as superior beings who resided above the common herd. They felt special, omnipotent, and worthy of being worshipped." Family members cursed with death before their time included Joe Kennedy Jr., World War II casualty, JFK, John Kennedy Jr., plane crash, Mary Richardson Kennedy, the wife of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who committed suicide, and David Anthony Kennedy, fourth of Ethel and Robert Kennedy's 11 children, who died of a drug overdose. Another of Robert Kennedy's sons, Michael Kennedy, was killed in a skiing accident during a family outing in Aspen, Colorado in 1998. And Saoirse Kennedy Hill, the only child of Courtney Kennedy Hill, the fifth of Robert and Ethel Kennedy's 11 children, died of an accidental drug overdose in 2012. In early April 2020, the Kennedy curse raged on. Maeve Kennedy Townsend McKean, granddaughter of Robert Kennedy, and her 8-year-old son Gideon Joseph Kennedy McKean perished in a canoe accident on Chesapeake Bay. One hates to think that having been poisoned with the middle name Joseph led to the tragedy for the youngster. Based on what happened in Dallas, Joe, Bobby, and John Kennedy were proven wrong. They were not immune to mortal laws. They were not divinely protected from the inevitable consequences of their deeds and misdeeds. And they were not untouchable after flaunting their power in the faces of dangerous men. The actions of these men, who believed they were privileged, had consequences. And the bad karma these actions triggered, the bad seeds sown into Bobby and John by Joe, grew into tragedies of the highest degree when retaliation came knocking at the door. In the final analysis, by focusing on why Robert F. Kennedy was not killed instead of why JFK was, nails in the coffin are pounded home for those who most contributed to JFK's demise. This author first considered that method of learning the truth after Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander said during a 2015 interview, "I was surprised JFK was dead. I had heard RFK was going to be killed because as many people as he had screwed, ones like local law enforcement that he stepped all over, or with people he hadn't kept his word with, underworld people like Carlos Marcello, politicians and the like, he just had too many enemies, many more than his brother." When JFK's assassination is viewed through this unique lens, those who contributed to the president's death are Joe, the poison patriarch, the dominating father who infected his sons with venomous moral and ethical defects through his own arrogance and sinful behavior; Bobby, the ruthless, at all costs, out of control law and order crusader who put his brother at risk; Carlos Marcello, the desperate mastermind, as will be shown, of the assassination so as to render Bobby powerless; and Mickey Cohen, the instigator at Marcello's order of a cover-up orchestrated by attorney Melvin Belli in his defense of Jack Ruby after he shot Lee Harvey Oswald so as to tie up any loose ends about JFK's assassination. A host of dark decisions and reckless ambition, initiated by Joe and extending through Bobby and also John, doomed JFK as president. His fate was sealed, as if ripped more from the pages of a Greek tragedy than from the sweet story of Camelot. Through a series of deceptions, lies, and betrayals, coupled with Bobby's personal vendetta against dangerous adversaries, Joe Kennedy, the powerful patriarch who abused power at every turn, drove these men toward hatred, revenge, and murder. It all points to an undeniable truth. John Fitzgerald Kennedy's tragic death could and should have been prevented. He did not have to die in Dallas.